Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your well-being and the well-being of your family and community and what's going on with our earth, water, air, food, what's going on with our society, what's going on with the environment of our planet Earth. Each week on the show, we discuss different facets of all of the different things in our interconnected world with activists, thought leaders, experts, scientists, authors, and more. I'm a longstanding journalist of the environment, food, and health, and we talk about policy, science, popular attitudes, and what the media is teaching us versus kind of omitting from the picture that we try to have to ferret out and get a better grip on. On today's show, I'm really happy to welcome back a guest who's been with us before. She's Pramila Malik. She's the founder of Protect Orange County and of Principal Progressives. She's also a former candidate for state senate in New York. And today we're going to be talking about, we've talked about pipelines, fracking, and fracking infrastructures before. Today we're going to be talking about, the real challenge in promoting a Green New Deal and really acting in this limited window that we have to act to protect from climate change in the 10 years that we have before us, given the pervasive corruption in our system, with a kind of clear and striking case study of what's going on behind the scenes that, you know, very rarely comes to light, but it does in this instance, and which afflicts people at all different places on the political spectrum. So happy to have you with us today again, Pramila, and welcome back to Connect the Dots.
Thank you for having me again, Allison.
So, you know, it's, you know, one of the things that I was contemplating in knowing we were going to be talking today on the show is that, you know, news is episodic. There are so many things marching by at any given moment in time. And, you know, people will tend to focus on one or two or five or more, but then, you know, the next week and there's a whole new group rushing in. And it's really hard for people to kind of keep watching and stand by and really observe the long-term effects and interconnections that are going on. You know, we'll see a moment of something and then kind of take that for everything. And in fact, there's a lot more to be revealed. And, you know, that's what we're kind of going to be talking about today, because you have really tracked something over a number of years, and there have been some very interesting developments. You and I first met and began our conversation that we're continuing on the air today when there was the building of a fracked gas compressor station in the future of your town, Minisink, New York. And I did an article on this for Alternet. And now here we are, and you can refresh me as to what year this actually was. Here we are many years down the line, and this has been built. And it's actually, you know, at the time when I reported this, and it was one of the first stories of sort of the new fracked gas pipelines and compressor stations that are part of what we call the fracking infrastructure. So at the beginning of the battle, or the beginning of the development and then consequent battle against fracking and fracked wells, you know, it just seemed like one locale and another locale and one fracked gas well, another one in this town or in that town or in this state or that state. But actually, we now can see that this is a whole network of and a whole progression with not only wells in one location, but with pipelines and compressor stations and export reports and all kinds of things going on all over this country and all over this world. So, you know, what was originally thought to be a NIMBY issue, there's a, you know, fracking is coming to my town or whatever, is actually a national and a global issue that has huge implications for climate change, because we're talking about frack gas and transporting it, and it's leaking at every one of these sources. So if we think about what, you know, the short timeline we have to intervene in a very negative environmental trajectory and our hopes for a Green New Deal, you know, frack gas has to be, and the, you know, its transport, production and use has to be really right central in our sights in terms of any discussion, in terms of, you know, really trying to intervene in this, in this mass industrial process. And so I'm just framing our conversation and your story with, you know, why this particular, you know, your constant sort of study and following and activism and organizing around this one energy center in one location is actually a microcosm of a macrocosm that's going on everywhere. And in this unusual instance, we really see, it's been revealed what's going on behind the scenes. So, you know, like, tell us where we are from that, you know, first, you know, the company wants to build it, the town doesn't want it, it gets built. Now that it's built, what comes to light that's so revelatory for all of us who want to see a better environment and future for ourselves and our families?
So it's been 8 years that I've been doing this. I didn't want to be, I mean, I've been an activist as a youth. I didn't really want to be doing this at, you know, age 50. I wanted to be able to take care of my children and my family, but they came knocking on my door, and I suddenly found myself not only in terms of, like, many things, you mentioned that, you know, people thought it was NIMBY. We are not NIMBY in the sense that everybody's front door, front, you know, backyard and front yard are interconnected by this global environmental crisis that we're facing. And I found myself standing on the precipice of not only a public health crisis, but the climate crisis. And, you know, we talk about, like, this moment, but this is probably the most consequential moment in human history, because we are talking about the survival of human civilization. So once I came to that realization that that the consequences were life itself, and that we were, our battle was really ground zero in this fight, and in this war for our children's future. The other thing I realized is that this agenda, this fracking enterprise agenda, is something that our entire political establishment has wholeheartedly bought into, and that we have become, we have descended into not just a crony capitalist society, but we have descended into an oil and gas republic. And when you become an oil and gas republic, everything becomes about, is made of oil and gas. And that's what you see in the way our public policy is formulated in this country. And New York State is a great state to kind of focus in on, to look at their energy policy and look at their climate policy and look at their environmental policy, along with how the government functions, because it is emblematic of what we see on a national scale and why we see methane emissions rising 30 to 60% globally. And it's 30 to 60% globally. And half of that is coming from the United States, and scientists believe that's from fracking. That was a Harvard study that came out a couple of years ago. In terms of the time frame that we're looking at, you know, everyone cites the IPCC report that says we have 10 to 12 years to change policies, but our climate scientists that testified at our civil disobedience trial, and they're two of the most prominent climate scientists in the world, and I'll explain the trial later if you ask me about it, but they testified actually that we actually have about 3 years to turn the ship around, and that was 2 years ago. So we have a really, really short window, and therefore the policies that we as a progressive movement advance and the leadership we choose is absolutely consequential, more now than ever before in our history. So that's why I think we need to talk about what's happening in New York State, what's happening under the leadership of our governor, Governor Andrew Cuomo. He is often lauded by environmentalists for banning fracking, but he actually didn't really ban fracking. It's really an executive moratorium, and he actually redefined what high-volume hydraulic fracturing is. And what he did was is he handed over New York State to the industry as a transportation corridor and as a market, which is exactly what the industry needed out of New York State. They didn't need New York State for extraction. There was a lot of science and data coming out that New York State did not have the amount of shale potential that the industry thought initially, but Pennsylvania certainly does. And so New York's role was really at the other end of the enterprise, the transportation and consumption end, whereas Pennsylvania, which is, fracked again by a Democratic governor, Pennsylvania is the extraction area. But what you see in terms of public policy, that all of our political leadership, and this is bipartisan across the spectrum, they are, by and large, all in support of the fracking enterprise, and they all, by and large, support policies that facilitate it. And what that means is that we have all been deemed expendable, because if you look at a map of pipeline infrastructure across the United States, there's not a single area or region of the country that isn't impacted. And pipelines are connected to compressor stations, are connected to power plants. This is why we call power plants the head of the black snake, because they drive the rest of the infrastructure. And we're talking about tens of thousands of miles of dangerous frac gas pipeline infrastructure spread throughout the country. New York State now largely derives its power from fracked gas, thanks to this power plant in my town that we've been fighting. And the country as a whole, in 2015, we started consuming more power from frack gas than from any other energy source. And so all of that was facilitated by former President Obama, who had a quote-unquote all-of-the-above energy policy, but it really was synonymous with frack our air, water, and soil. That really was the policy.
Yeah, that's really horrific. So in effect, we, and I say this as somebody who is really the first news cycle reporter to cover the fracking battle in New York State, we kind of won or partially won, a battle, but what you're saying is we have lost the war. And of course, so we've celebrated the victory, but we haven't continued to stay on the front line, stay vigilant, and to protect and surmount this ongoing foray. And, that has to in some way be dialed back. Now, specifically, who is behind this, as we can see in this particular instance? Who's behind it? Who's funding it? Because we see a political official. They claim to be an environmentalist, and yet, they're operating in relationship to other shady interests and enterprises that reach, into the pockets of, electeds and candidates in both parties. Who are the players, and how did the reality of this come into light?
So that's a loaded question. Let me take it in two parts. First, in terms of environmental victories, let me just say that I have no problems, and I totally support celebrating victories, big or small. What I'm saying is we really have to ask ourselves whether it really was a victory and not a cover. You know, because when you look at Pennsylvania, you know, this power plant that we ended up, we discovered that this compressor station was really connected to this power plant that was being proposed at the time and has subsequently been built. But this power plant is going to depend on 100 to 150 fracking wells per year. Granted, they'll likely be coming from Pennsylvania and parts of New York State that, you know, that are within, that are under that new threshold that Cuomo created. But nonetheless, what does an imaginary border really mean to our air and our water? I mean, if we're facilitating, like, the anti-fracking movement was predicated on the message of not one well, yet because of this power plant, we've actually approved 100 to 150 fracking wells. So my point is that I don't really think it was an environmental victory at all. I think it was a cover-up. And when we talk about the cause of our climate crisis, the lesson that I've learned is that it's because of corruption. So we did all of the research that any community organizer would do. We looked at the permitting process. We looked at the impacts. We looked at the environmental reviews. And we were able to identify, I mean, maybe about 10 really significant, substantial impacts that are not permissible by our current federal and state environmental laws. And yet every permit the compressor station was applying for and every permit the power plant was applying for was getting approved, despite all of these impacts, all of these violations in state and federal law. And that's when we began to conclude that something stinks here. And we began to publicly, way back in 2014, assert that corruption was behind it. We filed criminal complaints when the state ethics board wouldn't respond to us, and Cuomo's office wouldn't respond to us, and our legislators wouldn't respond to us, and the media was kind of ignoring the issue. Finally, we filed complaints with the U.S. Attorney's office, and I didn't think anything would happen with that because we were so accustomed to everybody ignoring this issue, even though it was the elephant in the room. This is, you know, while there was an environment, you know, one of the most mobilized environmental movements in the country was underway in New York State, yet nobody wanted to talk about CPV or acknowledge this the battle that we were going through. So we kind of had become accustomed to being ignored. So we filed these complaints anyway because there was some information was made known to us that the U.S. attorney was looking into the Cuomo administration, and we really felt like the approval and the facilitation of this project was coming from the Cuomo administration. And mind you, he had just, in December of 2014, he had just issued the quote-unquote ban on fracking. And as I said, because it was really via executive order, it really did become just a moratorium. In other words, only in effect as long as he's governor of the state of New York, not legislation that would have been permanent regardless of who's elected. But in any case, so we, you know, filed these complaints because we thought there's a huge disconnect here. He's banned fracking, but yet he's continuing to facilitate this power plant, which is going to be dependent entirely on fracked gas. And we felt that conflict of that disconnect could only be explained through corruption. So we, you know, filed our complaints, didn't think anything of it. Again, 2015, nobody really listened to us. We engaged in civil disobedience to try to get media attention because the media wasn't paying attention to us. And we had actor James Cromwell join us, which did get us a lot of media attention. Then when we were arrested we went to trial, we were lucky to actually be allowed to have a trial. And once again, because nobody was covering the actual impacts of this plant, we decided to use the trial as an opportunity to get all the impacts into an official record. And so we did end up having a trial. We pled not guilty, and we pled the necessity defense, and we had a civil disobedience trial. And that enabled climate scientists and public health scientists to come and testify in our trial. And finally, the facts about this plant became known to the public and was part of some official record that nobody could deny. And what our scientists testified to was that this plant, in and of itself, 650-megawatt frack gas power plant, would increase the state's greenhouse gas emissions by 10% of the power sector. That's a huge, whopping amount of greenhouse gas emissions. I think at a very, very conservative estimate, Dr. Anthony Ingraffia from Cornell put it at 4.3 million metric tons of CO2 plus methane annually, but it could go up to as high as 11 million metric tons of CO2 plus methane annually, depending on leakage rates, at a 12% leakage rate, which is what Dr. Bob Howard from Cornell as well, his research discovered that fracked gas actually leaks at about a 12% rate. So we're talking about a huge climate impact, huge increase in the state's greenhouse gas emissions, and still everybody was relatively quiet about it. Well, turns out, it was not a fruitless enterprise to file those complaints, because in 2016, suddenly, out of the blue, an indictment was announced by then U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Steve Ferrara, that indicted Governor Cuomo's closest aide, Joseph Prococo, who's known as so close to Cuomo, he's referred to him as his brother from another mother. And in that indictment, it said, do you want me to go on or?
Exclaiming. Yeah.
Yeah. In that indictment, it said that that Joseph Prococo was offered bribery money, was paid bribery money through a low-show job for his wife by Competitive Power Ventures, CPV, which is the company that built this fracked gas power plant in my county. And Competitive Power Ventures, it turns out, builds fracked gas power plants all over the country. And it turns out that this company paid his Joseph Prococo through his wife about $300,000, and he had a trial. It was a pretty alarming 3-month trial, seven-week trial, 8-week trial, and he was found guilty along with CPV's executive, Peter Kelly. Excuse me. And Peter Kelly is the son of a longtime Democratic Party central figure player. His name is Peter Braith Kelly, and he was chair of DNC fundraising for over a decade. And he, it turns out, used to be part of a lobbying firm with Roger Stone. So there is this whole interconnect of these really nefarious, big-moneyed interest lobbyists and players, and they're all tied to Governor Andrew Cuomo. And not only was the company bribing Cuomo's close aide, but they've given hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign donations to Andrew Cuomo during the entire approval process, and this has been about a 10-year approval process with dozens of state permits that the company had to get through. That whole time, they were donating huge amounts of money to his campaign fund, actually started donating to him when he was attorney general. And in the indictment, it said that Prococo was bribed to, and I'm quoting from the indictment, to, quote, shape New York State's energy policy. And part of that, one of the first requests they had was to get the governor to shut down Indian Point. And why did they need him to do that? Because they wanted to open up the market for their power plant. And in order to get investors to build it, they had to show that there was a market need for it. So they needed to have Indian Point shut down in order to do that. So when we talk about shaping the state's energy policy, what we're really talking about is shaping the state's climate policy, because our climate policy actually is our energy policy.
Wow. I just want to interject. I mean, you know, there were organizers and advocacy groups that were calling for Indian Point shutdown because it had failed a number of safety tests. It had failed to, repair the problems. And then there was a big, there was an initiative and a corresponding advocacy campaign against this initiative to build a gas pipeline through a nuclear power center. So just, in 2020 hindsight, I'm speaking, as a New Yorker here and part of the activist community as well as a reporter. But, at the time when Cuomo came in and said, yes, we must shut this, we thought it was going to be a terrific victory because it was like this looming threat 30 miles north of the city or so to have, a high-gauge gas pipeline, which, people weren't asking, why do we need a high-gauge gas pipeline? And it was really because this pipeline was to be built out up to, Maine and Canada for export, and that's why that was needed, and to build it right through a nuclear power plant. And so when then the governor began to call for its shutdown, we thought, oh, well, fantastic, we've prevailed, and, it's like and yet no one had any notion of there being the kind of backstage agenda and plan that was so much bigger than what we were looking at. So, this is just shocking.
Right. And the big question there is, why were the tritium leaks in Indian Point such a big health risk and safety risk, which, they are. They are a risk. I'm not saying there aren't. But why was that focused on, and not the fact that you had spent fuel rods within 100 feet of a high-pressure 44-inch gas pipeline, which is a catastrophic risk. I mean, we're talking about,
exactly.
We're talking about in comparison an enormous risk compared to a much, much, much smaller risk. So,
that's
and
true.
Why did New York State approve that pipeline? And it's very important to note that the pipeline that we were fighting, that the Minnesink compressor station was along, was the Millennium Pipeline, actually interconnects with the Spectra pipeline that goes through the Indian Point site. And then, on one end of the Millennium Pipeline, you have the CPV power plant, which is, depending on 150 fracking wells per year. But downstream of the Spectra pipeline, you have another CPV fracked gas power plant in Connecticut that's fed by the Spectra pipeline, that same AIM pipeline that goes through Indian Point. So you see all of these pipelines are interconnected. As I always say, we're connected not only by the pipelines that poison us, we're connected by the air we all breathe, the water we drink. We're connected also by the poisoning of our democracy that these fossil fuel companies cultivate. They really corrupt all of our politicians, all of our regulatory agencies. They all become beholden to these big moneyed interests. And that's what this story about CPV, how this plant was approved, who approved it, why it was approved, it really is emblematic of the crisis we face. We need to elect principled leaders.
Okay, we're not going to talk. Let's not go into.
But my point is that we need to have principled, progressive policies that don't horse trade on life and death issues. policies that don't say, you know, I'll shut down this nuclear power plant, but I'm going to replace it with a frack gas power plant. Do you know
right.
what I'm saying? We can't have policies
that trade
victims.
Yes, they have all of these plans. They have all these
right.
plans, and the whole plan isn't revealed so that the public can really participate. It's really hidden so the public cannot participate. They have a long-range plan that we don't know, and it's revealed episodically, town by town, as we build out each new segment of the pipeline under a different name, and then, you know, it's another NIMBY neighborhood. But in fact, you know, it's all across the United States, and they have the master plan, and we're not privy to it. And then the politicians are enlisted. Now, just to backtrack, one thing you mentioned is that, you know, a key lobbyist for Governor Cuomo was also formerly, you know, in a firm with Roger Stone. So, you know, mm-hmm. according to our, you know, political understanding, how could it be that, you know, the person who was a, you know, a big player in Donald Trump's advent is also, you know, has this affiliation, I don't know how strong or loose it is, maybe you have a better idea, you know, with a politician on the other side of the aisle, and obviously probably not one, but many politicians on both sides of the aisle. Like, what is going on there?
Well, these are the games of the duopoly that I call them. But, you know, this is how these big moneyed interests operate. Like, they donate to Republicans, they donate to Democrats, and they stick their finger in the air and say, well, this is the, you know, this is the way the political winds are blowing today. And they'll give you a candidate that, you know, says the things that you want to hear. And Cuomo has, like, especially in the last 2 years, has really tried to present himself as the anti-Trump leader in the United States. And, you know, everything Trump did or said, you know, Cuomo had to comment on. But, yeah, if you look at the roots of how both these leaders came to power, you find some common friends. You find some common allies like Roger Stone. Roger Stone, when Cuomo came to power and when Cuomo ran in 2010, he supported him. He told his fellow Republicans that he liked Andrew Cuomo and people should support him. So, you know, and there's a lot of other common players. It's not just Kelly. When Prococo, this is the Cuomo aide that was convicted, who ironically is now serving his prison sentence in Orange County.
Oh my goodness.
breathing in those toxic CPV fumes, so that's a little poetic justice for you there. But CPV, it's interesting. You know, as soon as his trial began in 2017, they increased their lobbying spending in New York State, not decreased it. They didn't run away. They didn't run out of town. They increased their lobbying spending by fourfold. I think they spent $180,000 just in New York State in from 2016 to 2017. That's a huge increase in the amount of lobbying money they were spending. They also started spending money, lobbying money in D.C. And through in New York State, they used a lobbyist named Michael McKeon from Mercury, the firm called Mercury Advising, and they are lobbyists who are very close to the Cuomo administration. But in D.C., CPV used Mike McKenna, who was part of Trump's energy transition team, and they used Mike McKenna to lobby the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Because in order to facilitate their build-out, and again, remember, they build these power plants all over the country, they needed not just the cooperation of state governments and state legislatures and state governors, but they also needed the cooperation of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, because power plants, gas-fired power plants, can't operate without gas pipeline. And so that's the role of FERC. So, and they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars lobbying FERC at the time. So, again, you see these common players, you know, whether it's lobbying to Trump or whether it's, you know, Republican president or whether it's lobbying our Democratic governor, you see, you know, common bedfellows, common business partners and allies and people who work together. And it really demonstrates how corrupt the system has become, that it can reach everyone and every institution, whether it's a regulatory agency like California's Air Quality Board. CPB actually had California's air regulations changed, and by changed, I mean weakened, in order to allow for one of their power plants. And their power plant that serves the L.A. County area. Now, if you look at all of the projects this company has approved, they've got a power plant, this power plant in New York, which serves the New York metro area, and the New York metro area is the second largest consumer of power in the world, now pumped into frack gas. It's building a power plant just outside of L.A., feeding the L.A. metro area. Now, L.A. is plugged into frack gas from Wyoming. It's got a power plant in the that it just developed in the Maryland area, serving the D.C. metro area. It's got a power plant in Connecticut, in Oxford, Connecticut, along the AIM pipeline, serving the New England market. So you see that this one single company has plugged a large number of American residents, American citizens, they've plugged them into frack gas dependency by force, by coercion. And not only that, but because of regulatory changes they've been able to effect through their lobbying of FERC, they are forcing us as utility ratepayers to actually pay for all of this construction. So, you know, we have descended, as I said, we've descended into a oil and gas republic, into an oligarchy, but an oligarchy that largely serves the oil and gas industry. And, you know, the pharmaceutical industry and the healthcare industry, they all follow suit. They all, you know, they all see how the fossil fuel industry does it, and then they all just copy. But, yeah, this is really one of the most nefarious interests in this country today. And, again, it is not only destroying our environment and our children's future, but our democracy as well.
Yeah, this is really grim. So, you know, it's really important for this information to come to light and for us to have this conversation at this moment of time because, you know, when we hear people responding, for example, to the Green New Deal or other initiatives and saying, you know, we have to do this slowly and, you know, or we don't know how we can do it at all, or how is this going to be possible, or, yeah, I believe in, you know, man-made activities contributing to climate change, but, you know, this is too much and we can't do it. When we hear people saying that, and then we go to, you know, something like Open Secrets and look who's financially supporting them, or when we look at a roster of candidates and ask if anyone's, you know, taken the fossil fuel pledge or whatever, you know, all of these things, you know, it's like there's this tremendous imperative. We have the Sunrise Movement and the children concerned about climate from all over the world, leaving school and striking. And yet, in effect, we're captured and, you know, and have been in a way taught to accept that and to buy into it and to regard that as like an unalterable status quo, just the way things are. And, you know, we kind of have to stay in accord with some of these norms of consensus that allow for all of this. And yet on the other side, you know, and yet we're not going to make it. You know, we're not going to make it if we continue to allow for this. And, you know, I mean, and on the other side, there are people like Mark C. Jacobson from Stanford and others who have, you know, sketched out plans for how we can begin a transition. There are economists, you know, who are pointing out ways that we can, it's really about shifting investment. And, you know, so, I mean, when people, when politicians look in their pocket and they say, you know, my pocket is empty, the cupboard is bare, we have no way to fund this. I mean, it's like, what we're really saying is we have to shift the funding, the public investment, not toward what was spuriously first characterized as a bridge to renewables. There's no bridge. It's a massive infrastructure that is built on the public dime. And we have to shift that money and that investment. And these companies and the beholden politicians, they don't want that happening, obviously.
Right. And I would say that the message about cost is really deceptive rhetoric, right? Because, again, once again, if you zoom in to our struggle in Orange County, what you'll see is, in fact, we are paying for these frack gas power plants because we're paying for them on our utility bills because of the regulatory scheme, you know, that are cooked up by corrupt lobbyists. And we're also paying for it in terms of all the externalities. So there's already a cost that nobody, you know, wants to acknowledge or address that we are paying for right now. And Dr. Ingrassia did an analysis of this particular power plant. So not only are we paying for it through our utility bills, the plant received millions of dollars in state subsidies. They have a payment in lieu of taxes agreement, which allows them to pay over 20 years $40 million in taxes, as opposed to what they should be paying if they were taxed like everybody else, $443 million is what they should be paying over 20 years. They're actually going to pay a fraction of that, 10% of that. So that's another subsidy passed on to the public. Then there's decreasing home values. That's another loss that the public has to face. But Dr. Ingrassia did an analysis just on the externalities from increasing healthcare costs and infrastructure damage from this power plant because of its toxic and greenhouse gas emissions, $900 million per year. $900 million per year is what it costs society to allow that plant to operate. So when they talk about cost of a Green New Deal, they never acknowledge the cost that we are paying by not going green. And when this company came in to, quote-unquote, shape New York State's energy policy, and when they, you know, were able to buy that that ability, they not only wanted Indian Point shut down, they also blocked the development of 8,000 megawatts of onshore wind that are sitting in the NYISO queue. NYISO is the organization that regulates energy development in New York State. And if you want to develop a project, you have to apply to them. There are 8,000 megawatts of developers ready to build windmills in upstate New York that were just waiting for a power line to be able to bring that power to downstate market. And it was blocked by this power plant company because of their lobbying, because of their ability to buy influence in Albany. So,
how do you know that it was blocked, Pramila? How do we know that it was blocked?
Well, because the company, the corruption goes very, very deep in New York State. The state senator that represented the district that this company developed this project in is actually the person that I ran against as state senator, as a state senate candidate, John Bonasek, and his son was actually attorney for the company at the same time that the father was lobbying on behalf of the company. And one of the things the father lobbied for or advocated for and was able to effect was to block the construction of that power line to bring that downstate market. So, yes, I'm speculating to a certain extent that it was on behalf of the company. But, yeah, I stand by that allegation. The company, CPV, was the prime beneficiary of that action.
My goodness. So, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so the upshot of it, the conclusion is that the real cause of our climate crisis is corruption. We tend to blame it on methane and CO2, and, you know, yes, they're probably the bullets, but who's shooting the bullets? It's corruption.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I did a piece for Truth Out, and it was rather shocking because we weren't able to get a stronger Paris Agreement, one that would really have had teeth in it, that would have been more effective. Granted that, of course, Trump has bowed out of that in any case, but it's often used as a benchmark for people, and some states have passed it, you know, even though it isn't anywhere near as meaningful as it needs to be, because, you know, and at the time, Obama didn't feel that he could, you know, he had to kind of bow to the other side of the aisle, and he couldn't go any further with it, he believed. But at the same time, he actually loosened the laws that regulate and that have regulated in the past these pipelines until we basically, and sped their passage. You know, he gutted key legislation that had always been protective. So, you know, it's like anyone salutes any politician as climate friendly, you know, you got to like kind of take a closer look. Is sadly, you know, the case.
Right, especially with the Green New Deal, because it really is important, and we can't let that become so ambiguous that we lose sight of what needs to be done. It's absolutely mm-hmm. clear. It doesn't need to, there's no need for ambiguity. And in fact, ambiguity and incrementalism will kill us. It's the equivalent mm-hmm. of rearranging the chairs on the deck of the Titanic as it goes down. In order to stop the climate crisis, it's very easy. We need to, number one, shut down all fracked gas power plants. That needs to be step one. And at the same time, we need to build up utility-scale renewables. And it can be done. It's not a question of whether it can be done. As you cited Mark Jacobson, it absolutely can be done, and it can be done in a much quicker time frame than anyone is willing to admit. Again, the delays, the distractions, the ambiguity, this is all industry trickery and deception. And if we want our children to have a future, we need to crack through that deception. And as I always say, climate truth lies in the crack between climate denial on the one side, but climate deception on the other side.
Climate deception, yeah, right. That's really true. And, you know, I think what this tells us, I mean, what's happened here is that as a dedicated citizen and organizer and activist, you have really been, following this horrifying bunny trail, for 8 years. And, you know, most people just get an episodic view. They regard it as an issue not connected to themselves. They are, you know, they stand ready to believe statement of any politician or a political figure or someone, a candidate or anything. People think that they can take them at their word. It's extraordinarily naive, really, if you kind of look further or deeper or wonder what that person is really about or who's really funding them, it's kind of, and aren't just buying that sort of superficial presentation, you know, about their personality or something, in a few of their positions, which may sound novel and interesting, you know, how is anyone, you know, really functioning according to not something entertaining and diverting or nice or maybe, you know, that would appeal to me, but really according to the number one priority of our time for human survival. You know, and so that's really what we're talking about here, and it is less pleasant, you know, than some of these other conjectures. But, you know, I really am, you know, very grateful to you for putting all of, you know, connecting the dots, putting all these pieces of the puzzle together, and they form, you know, a very you know, unpleasant picture, to put it mildly. I mean, these, you know, it's like, you know, when Standing Rock happened, a lot of our fellow activists, you know, went out there, and it really, you know, the message about the destructiveness of these infrastructures wherever they go began to kind of seep through in the public mind. Without, you know, the kind of palpable spiritual groundedness, you know, of indigenous peoples, of, you know, who are from this original land, you know, it's a, you know, it isn't as sort of, it doesn't inspire. They, you know, they are able to inspire through their passion and love and true understanding of our oneness with the water and being a water protector, an earth protector, an air protector. You know, they really can inspire other, you know, when, but this, to me, story is also inspirational because, you know, to keep, like, to smell corruption and then to find that it's there, this is the real job of investigating. And with so much of the media, you know, that you're doing, and so much of the media is owned, you know, that they're not really looking into or reporting on this. I mean, the whole time that the battle over the pipeline through the nuclear power plant was happening, the New York Times never reported on it once until the governor said, well, I, you know, may close it down, right?
Right.
And so that was newsworthy, and that was like the only time they had anything to say about it. And, you know, and in the past presidential election, you know, we had a candidate saying, oh, you know, it just needs better regulations, you know, and yet anyone who has dealt with the regulators knows that, you know, they're influenced as well, as you said, FERC, which regulates this infrastructure, pipelines and everything, you know, is subject to tremendous lobbying pressure and doesn't really, isn't functionally set up for authentic public accountability. And it never was, you know, from its beginning, because it was really shaped to this role by, you know, the former Vice President Cheney, whose company Halliburton is a huge champion of all of this kind of gas development.
Right.
So, you know, thank you for the tremendous work you've been doing, Pramila Malik. It's, you know, and for bringing the story to connect the dots. And, you know, people should pay attention to it because there may be future developments. And, you know, we'll have you back again. Thank you for all your tremendous dedication and hard work.
Thank you so much. And we do have a petition if you want to sign it. We're asking for oversight hearings in the New York State Legislature. You just go to tinyurl.com/builtonbribes. tinyurl.com/builtonbribes. If you could link that petition, again, we think the oversight hearing, I think we think we've only uncovered a fraction of what's really out there, and we think oversight hearings will reveal the rest of the full story. And we have a Democratic state legislature show, so there should be no excuses.
Yes, thankfully, it's like a new experience and a new possibility for New York State. Thank you for being with us, Pramila, and thank you, listeners, for being with us on this week's Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Be well.